You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Sarah Lawson and Lee Norton. Sarah and Lee, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
So we're going to talk about your collaborative work. I know you're both in Brooklyn now. In this time, we're talking on Thursday, October 15th. Just before we talked, and I want to hear about what's happening in your studio, but you guys have just returned to kind of the studio, right? During the pandemic, which is obviously still on, you were kind of away from the studio. Is that what happened?
We had, when everything got locked down in mid-March, we were out for a couple months, and then kind of one by one, we each established our own path to coming back. So I started coming back maybe like May, and I was doing a day at a time, 2 days, and Lee kind of gradually came back as well, and now we're sort of back to our regular-ish schedule as much as we can be. We have a capacity of a certain number of people. Yeah,
I'll just add that Sarah and Matvei, two members of our working group here, really were instrumental in keeping it going. I also had a child around March, so I was out for a while regardless. And we work with a yearly group of apprentices, and we were able to keep the last group of apprentices on a little bit longer, and they were actually able to keep us working virtually without too much of a hitch, I think, in terms of producing the books in the sense of editorial work, layout work, and getting them shipped to the printer. So thanks to those people, less so myself, we managed to, I think, keep things moving more or less as we had intended.
So let's talk about that. We're talking about the distribution of publications, right? And so to just give the big picture of what you guys are doing, can either you or Sarah give me a sense of how you came together and began everything that you're doing? How did this collaboration begin? And if you could tell us a little bit about your mission.
Yeah.
Sure.
Well, I guess briefly, our mission, is that we are a publisher of mostly poetry, poetry in translation, experimental nonfiction, performance texts, and books by artists. That's the bulk of what we publish. We put out 20 to 25 titles a year. We have a volunteer editorial collective that does the work of selecting the books that we publish and editing those books, also working on their design with the authors. And we also have a small staff, of which Lee and I are a part. I am currently the publicity director. Lee is the development director, and we are also editors. So we're on the volunteer editorial collective, on which we are part of that group that selects the titles that we publish and works on them. And then we also have our sort of day jobs here at UDP, where we carry out the sort of administrative tasks, making sure that we write copy and making sure we get the grants in on time, and we sort of share those tasks.
I could talk a little bit about that. Sure. As Sarah mentioned, we kind of have been doing this for a while, and the real core unit around which UDP coalesced was this kind of volunteer editorial collective, which has always been a central, if always negotiated, kind of aspect of this project, this collaborative project, which just celebrated its 25th year. So Sarah and I think
congratulations,
it's fair to say,
both
are,
of you. Yes,
yeah,
amazing.
Yeah. Well, we've joined in the past, 5 to 10 years, the both of us. So it it's an inheritance for us that we're always kind of discovering, rediscovering
right.
personally, coming to grips with. But yeah, it came together in the early 90s in New York, and for about 10 to 15 years was just a collaborative group of artist friends calling themselves junior artists and aspiring to really, they were doing a lot of work in the downtown New York scene, kind of thinking about ways to puncture some of the self-seriousness with staging events like anti-readings, which were more like carnivals than poetry readings, publishing kind of in a more come what may spirit, working collaboratively to put out things like the Emergency Gazette, which was just a bulletin, a news sheet that they published for a while. Over time, it's kind of become what it is today. I think an important element of what has always kind of joined us together is looking to find a place for us as independent and kind of self-taught, slightly irreverent publishers to give a space to the sorts of work that just would not find room for publication or distribution according to sort of more mainstream market logics. Basically, a lot of the work we publish is work we feel is intrinsically valuable, whether it's the recovery of or the republication and perhaps first translation into English of experimental works from other national traditions, or, as Sarah said, translation, but we tend not to focus on, for example, German and French translation, but Eastern mm-hmm. European and contemporary Latin American translation, even some farther flung stuff as well. Recently some, or in the near future, some Southeast Asian poetry in translation, places that don't really get well covered or well served by the more mainstream sort of publishing establishment as it is currently constructed.
Right, and so you know it's so remarkable that you've brought together these artists and writers that are often not getting the attention of some of their peers. The question seems to be, especially in this anniversary, you know, how do you survive? It's kind of a form that's not about mass market, right? You're dealing with poetry and with figures who aren't about selling thousands and thousands of copies. You're a small press. How does it survive? That's what's remarkable and what we're really celebrating in part in this interview, right? How does it reach its public or get into the culture so it gets supported?
Yeah. I mean, sure. I would say it's a constant sort of thing that we're navigating. And I think 25 years, I mean, it was quite momentous because, especially looking back at those early roots where it was very DIY and making zines and just doing sort of spontaneous performative things. Now we have reached a point where, you know, we have been a nonprofit for maybe 16 or so years now, and we have a sort of like reliable stream of books coming out, income coming in, and can actually support like a small staff. So I think that we've, in the last five, maybe so years, we've kind of, I think, moved from a baseline survival mode to starting to think about like what other programs can we invest our time and energy in? What are the kinds of things we can develop that enrich our, not just our publishing program, but the community that we're a part of. There are times like this year when all of the bookstores were closed, so we weren't seeing anything from there. And, you know, we weren't able to get our books out in the same way that we had perhaps expected to do. We have to kind of like, we've had to tighten our belts and see where we can kind of shift things around. It's a challenge.
Right.
Yeah.
But the funding is essentially what supports it is sales of books as well as with most nonprofits, like donations and fundraising? Is that a big part of it?
Right.
Yeah. No, that is undeniably a big part, and I can speak a little to that, I suppose. I mean, I think, you know, we often think about the decision to incorporate as a nonprofit, which happened in incorporation was 2002, 2003, and then 2004 we got our nonprofit status. And you know, that's a decision that a lot of small independent presses come down on either side of. And I think you will see. In fact, we share some real estate with about five other presses in this amazing Old American Can Factory, this space that has provided really reasonable rents for small nonprofits like us, and it's been our home for about a dozen years. And just across the way, there are other small independent presses that have you know, sort of definitively chosen, you know, will not do the nonprofit thing, because it's true. You know, it does mean that decision was something that kind of committed us to being answerable to a sense of sustainability, and knowing that we were going to be supported by grants, by donations. The truth is, our community is what makes it all possible. They're incredibly generous in helping kind of making ends meet. Sales are obviously a huge part of it, and we're really, really actually proud of the percentage of our income that like is just books getting into the hands of readers who value the work and pay for the work, but our community has always made it possible for us to exist through donations. And then, yes, writing grants, you know, federal, state, local grants, you know, appealing to foundations for help. These are always parts of the puzzle. And I'll stop there because it gets quite boring quite fast.
Okay, no, that's
yeah.
To talk
I mean,
about
I would also
very
that,
exciting
mention.
Just to have these things go out into the air. And please, I want you to mention to continue, Sarah. So just hold that thought. But I'm interested in this in this topic. I think it is interesting because it's how the arts survive in this moment, you know. But also how how things like the press can survive. So I want you to the comment you were going to say, Sarah, but I was also interested in what, and perhaps you can answer this, Sarah, too, what Lee was saying about, you know, there are other presses that maybe haven't made the decision to become a nonprofit. what's the downside to becoming a nonprofit? Why the struggle? I mean, I have some inkling to that, but yeah, I was wondering what the downside seems to be, because in a way it would seem to be a win-win to have nonprofit status.
Well, there's a lot of it is by and large the right decision for us, particularly given the way that our mission really is explicitly non-commercial, even anti-commercial, if you think that what we are trying to do is to provide that platform to the sorts of work that are not served by a commercial paradigm, a capitalist paradigm, whereby a book would have to justify its publication and the effort and time that went into it strictly via sales. So for us, it has been foundational to how we conceive our work. We, you know, to be a nonprofit. I think that the reason that other presses might go in other directions you are then making yourself answerable to the government, to your funders, I won't say that it's a problem so much as something to safeguard against falling into that sort of bureaucratic rhythm of justifying the work you do and shaping the work that you do around the kinds of projects that are getting institutional approval and support via funding, rather than the other way around.
That's very good. That's a very interesting, kind of more nuanced the notion to it, right? That there is that's interesting, right? There's the board.
There's the dilemma.
Right.
Yeah. The dilemma is essentially kind of just staying vigilant and making sure that we're not doing work to satisfy funders so we can continue to exist, but rather that we are being creative and strategic and always keeping at the forefront of our mind the work that we think is important to do, and then the funding is the thing that comes second. But I don't want to make it all about that, because really it is a necessity of what we do and of who we are now, but it is not what drives us. I don't know, Sarah, what was it that you were hoping to add?
Well, I guess not so much related to this particular part of the conversation, but I was going to add that another big part of what helps us survive is that we have so many that are volunteering their time. Not only our editorial collective, a very dedicated group of about 11 volunteers at this time, but also a larger community of folks who we call upon when we have something like a chapbook to bind or subscription packages to mail out, which we'll be doing rather soon, actually. And, you know, we can't really do it on the same scale that we have in the past because of COVID. But in the last, you know, for a long time, we've had 10 or 15 people will come on a volunteer day. And it's a way that people make connections to one another. We've had people meet and start their own presses from meeting at a volunteer day. And so it really fosters that community and also allows us to get a lot of stuff done that we wouldn't necessarily be able to get done during our scant administrative hours.
Right.
Yeah. It's part of our values. You know, it's volunteering in this like labor of love is not just like as a sort of like where can we cut corners. It's more of like how do we find ways to foster community and foster conversations and bring people together to do this thing that wouldn't otherwise happen if we didn't.
And if I may, yeah. it just bears restating, as Sarah mentioned, and I meant to say this before in even more emphatic terms, but the volunteer editorial collective really drives everything. The books are entirely edited by this volunteer group, some of whom have happened to join staff as well. But that's all by design volunteer work, has been for a long time. And so that is the other, yes, that is the labor that makes it possible, for sure.
And so for the foreseeable future, is there any announcements you want to make or anything before I ask you guys the last question? But there's information about the press in here and links to what you guys are doing. And I know you have subscriptions as well. Is there anything you want to plug in? You could mention just how the subscription works if you want, because there's a full press subscription that people can have, right? I should ask that. So what do they get for
The full press subscription is a way to get all of the books that we publish in any given year. There are different payment options for it. You can do a $20 per month option, or you can pay up front at $240. And that's, you know, you get all the chapbooks, all the full length books. You even get some ephemera, some broadsides, notebooks, a tote bag, swag like that. And I also would mention that this year in particular, we are kind of doing a special publishing program, which is called the 2020 Pamphlet Series. So we decided to sort of focus our energies on publishing a selection of 20 pamphlets that would function as more immediate text, a little bit more spontaneous. We commissioned those essays. So that's also a subscription we have, and you can get all of 20 pamphlets for $100, which is a pretty good deal.
Or $20 a month.
Definitely keep an eye out for that.
But that's also the $20 a month. That's a full subscription, or?
Titles, and then the pamphlet subscription is just pamphlets, a selection of 20 pamphlets. And then the full press subscription is all of our books, so all of the pamphlets, chapbooks, full lengths, anything that comes out, which is more like 20 to 25.
Right. Very good.
I'll just add that the if you want to support the work that we're doing, those subscriptions are really crucial to us, not only, getting our books into the hands of readers for a pretty decent discount, but they provide us some sense of, like, stability, because it can really fluctuate, you know. And the other thing that I would just say about the subscription is it's a great way. A lot of people, you know, buy subscriptions and then sort of essentially gift them to a local library or something like that. So you can do that as well. The subscription is really something that has helped us survive for many years, giving us some sense of guaranteed income during tricky times like these.
That
makes sense. And so there's also links here for that for everyone listening. I just want to ask you guys the last question now, which is, what are you each reading at the moment? I imagine you guys are always reading and editing all kinds of things for the press, but yeah, what are you both reading at the moment?
I am currently reading, I have two books. I'm not willing to do more than two at a time right now, but one of them is a book of essays by Donna Haraway. I think it's called Simians, Cyborgs, and Women. And it has her her seminal cyborg manifesto in it, and just is a bunch of essays on her work. And I'm also reading a novel by a Nigerian writer called People of the City. The novelist's name is Cyprian Ekwensi. So those are my two main things. And also in the middle of reading a very large batch of submissions that we had an open call over the summer. So.
Yeah, we're reading a lot of books right now. They're just all in manuscript form.
Fledgling books.
My other answer is a little out there, perhaps, reading a book about the ethics of pastoral care that just happened to be written by my grandfather, and I was just kind of curious about his life, so I was reading what he had to write. Yeah, I doubt it's available for purchase. The other thing I'm reading right now is it's not super fresh off the press, but it's relatively new. One of our authors, Tammy Nguyen, runs a press called Passenger Pigeon Press. Does these amazing quarterly publications that have a lot of intricate manual handmade bookwork where the design of the book objects and they just kind of get mailed out to you. So I'm reading the most recent issue of Martha's Quarterly, which is the publication of Passenger Pigeon Press. It's very excellent. I recommend anyone to go check out Tammy Nguyen.
Thank you. Thank you both for your time today and the great work you're doing with the press. Thanks again, and I wish you both well.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thanks for having us. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.